Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here is your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Welcome to this episode of Frankly Speaking. I'm your host, Frank Rossi, Cornell University Extension Turfgrass Specialist and TurfNet.com. You're listening to the TurfNet Radio Network, and this is Frankly Speaking. In this episode, we're speaking frankly with Dr. Micah Woods, Chief Scientist of the Asian Turfgrass Center. As usual, new with TurfNet this week, there's a really good webinar coming up with my colleague at NC State University, Grady Miller, where he'll give us a quote-unquote primer on turf colorants and pigments. And for those of you who have really not spent enough time trying to understand some of the science behind these pigments and colorants, I'd urge you to sit in on Dr. Miller's presentation. They've done some really interesting work down there at NC State, and I think you're going to find that understanding this technology from a scientific perspective about exactly what is happening, what kinds of plant responses we get, all the way from warming of the turf to potential induced systemic resistance that you get, as well as the copper-based pigments offering some fungicide activity as well. You'll find, I'm sure, Dr. Miller will do a fine job of taking us through navigating the pigments, paints, and dyes. So look for that webinar on March 17th, as usual, 1 o'clock TurfNet time. And when we come back, we'll start our conversation with Dr. Micah Woods, Chief Scientist at the Asian Turfgrass Center. Stay with us.
From day to day and season to season, you never know what nature has in store for you. That's why Revolution from Aquatrols is trusted by superintendents worldwide in a variety of climates. More than 10 years of university trials have shown that Revolution is a superior surfactant for optimizing soil moisture. Whether you're battling too much rain or not enough, Revolution can help you attain the proper moisture balance in the root zone for healthy, resilient turf and drier, firmer playing surfaces. Revolution from Aquatrols, the world leader in turf grass water management.
And welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi, and joining me this week is Dr. Micah Woods. Micah is the Chief Scientist at the Asian Turfgrass Center. And Micah has really sort of broken the mold for a lot of scientists out there in the southeastern part of the world, Southeast Asian part of the world. And while he's out there informing that part of the world about warm season grasses and impacts of light, he spent a lot of time developing two, I think, really important aspects of two new approaches to dealing with managing turf, whether it's in cool season or warm season climates, both the minimum level of sustainable nutrition that he's been developing with Dr. Larry Stoll, and also integrating the growth potential model into this fertility, into this turf nutrition approach. And of course, the minimum level of sustainable nutrition comes directly from the Global Soil Survey that Mike has been working on. And without any further ado, I welcome Micah to the program here. Micah, are you with us?
I think I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, you are with us. That's exactly right. Well, that is getting
awesome.
Inside the wire. Thanks for taking the time, Micah. Where would we find you today?
You would find me in Bangkok today. I'm at my home office in Bangkok.
Excellent, excellent. So let me get right to it. You know, we worked together, as many people may or may not know, back at the turn of the century when you were here studying your master's and PhD. And at that time, we were doing some nutrition Turfgrass nutritional research, primarily focused on potassium, but I think, as you'd probably agree, it really evolved to a general critique of soil nutrient analysis. And so would you say that that was sort of the genesis of this sustainable nutritional approach that you've taken, Micah? And why don't you talk to us a little bit about sort of how you got to it, and then we'll get to the Global Soil Survey and make sure we get as many listeners involved as we can. So how did you decide on this minimum level of sustainable nutrition?
Well, that is a good question, and I think it started before I even went to Cornell. Before I went to Cornell, I was a golf course superintendent in China and in Japan. And when I was in China, I was growing grass, but I didn't really have a chance to send soil samples for analysis. So I always wanted to have the grass that was as healthy as possible. And I was very, very curious about how many nutrients I should be supplying to make sure that the grass was very good. But I didn't know, and I didn't really even have any data to look at. Now, even if I did have data, then I don't know that I would have been able to interpret it or do very much with it. But I was very curious about making grass as healthy as possible by making sure it's supplied with the right nutrients. So I was very fortunate that when I went to grad school, you were interested in that same topic. And so we were able to do the projects that really focused on potassium and other cations such as calcium, magnesium, and looking at different soil testing methods and especially looking in sand root zones. And it turns out that sand root zones just don't hold very many nutrients. So we were testing in so many different soil types, so many different sand types, growing grass in them. And it was interesting that when you'd look at what the recommendations, what the conventional guidelines, as I would call it now, what the conventional guidelines are for nutrients, you know, maybe 120 parts per million for potassium, 180 parts per million for potassium, something like that. And no matter how much potassium we put down, there's just no way in a lot of sands that turf grass is growing in, there's no way you can get nutrient levels that high. So I kind of changed my thinking. Before I went to grad school, I would apply as much potassium or twice as much potassium as nitrogen, thinking that that was really making the grass very stress tolerant and that was making the grass more healthy. And I was really shocked when I went to grad school and we did the experiments and I found out that even when the soil was much, much lower in potassium and we didn't apply as much potassium, the turf was equally good, sometimes even better. So in the 5 years that I was at Cornell and looking at thousands of soil test results and doing lots of experiments about that, I kind of came to understand what the numbers mean when we extract nutrients from the soil, and I realized the conventional guidelines were broken. So and for me, this isn't so much the new guidelines that I've developed together with the scientists from Pace Turf. We call it the MLSN, which stands for Minimum Levels for Sustainable Nutrition. But it's kind of because that is what they are, and also we needed like some kind of acronym for them because we have to call them something. But my interest in this is not so much reducing fertilizer inputs. My interest is in making sure that we supply the turf with just the right amount of nutrients. And so that's what I've been focusing on.
Let me interject here. So you've got these target values now, which are, you know, by every measure, I think when you look at traditional, what you call conventional, even the SLN, the sufficiency level approach, we're not even going to bother with the base cation approach, but the sufficiency level approach, what you're suggesting, and I want to make sure we clarify this for the listeners, that, you know, what you're talking about here is very much focused on sand-based root zones from samples around the world where people have said they've had really good turf, and you looked at the numbers and developed a statistical model. So let's go a little bit further now with the model itself and why you think this is a level or a bunch of targets that nutritional targets that golf superintendents should at least take a good look at as they're developing their nutrition program. What makes this, in your mind, different than the more conventional approach? Is it just the sand focus on it, Micah, or is it the way you've got the data, the way the data is analyzed? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, the two big differences, I think. One big difference is that if you try to interpret the conventional guidelines, the SLANs, sufficiency level of available nutrients, if you try to interpret those, you'll find that they are like classifying an element such as phosphorus as very low, low, medium, high, or very high. So you might find that you're at 50 parts per million and it's classified as medium. And then the question is, well, is medium good or should we be high? Or what if you come in very high, then does that mean that it's toxic? You need to reduce it. It's vague. It's ambiguous. It's not clear how much of an element that you should apply. And if you try to find out where the SLAN guidelines came from, or if you try to find out who's supporting them, who's saying right now that they're actually good for the way that turf's managed in 2015, I think you really struggle to find anybody supporting them or anybody that can answer the question or justify why that number works. So one of the big differences is with the MLSN guidelines, we answer questions about them almost on a daily basis. Pace Turf website, you can find information. There's a Facebook page about it. I blog about it all the time, and I answer a lot of emails about it. I was answering emails about it today. So if you have questions, you're going to get an answer. And also, these guidelines have already been updated more than once. We released them in 2012, and the first update, as we added new data, and also we're going to talk about the Global Soil Survey. We added the Global Soil Survey data and updated them in September of 2014. And some of the nutrient guidelines went up, some of them went down based on the new data. So one of the big differences is these are updated. These are something that people will answer questions about. And also, we wanted, or I certainly, one of the things that I really wanted to do is make it simple. I don't like ambiguity. I think soil testing is useful when it's a decision-making tool. And if you have ambiguity in how you're interpreting the results, you can't really have it as a decision-making tool. So the idea was, instead of having these ranges, we just pick a single number that we don't want to drop below. So I think target is a little bit misleading, and I think some people have misunderstood this and think that we're suggesting that people should actively try to maintain the nutrient levels in the soil very low at the what we're calling the guideline level. But the way that these guidelines work is we're saying, based on our analysis of the data from good performing turf all around the world, that we're very confident that if the soil nutrients are at the guideline level or above, so mainly they're going to be above. So as long, what we say is we don't want to drop below this level. So it's not so much it's a target that we're shooting for, it's a minimum level, which is in the guideline name, minimum levels for sustainable nutrition. It's a minimum level that we don't want to drop below. And so with the conventional guidelines, you look at a number, it's not clear how you interpret it. But with the MLSN guidelines, the guideline level is only one part. It's only one of three numbers that we need to know. So one thing that's kind of innovative and different about this approach is we're looking at three things. We're looking specifically at the minimum. We're looking at only one level in the soil that we don't want to drop below. Then we look at the soil test and we measure how much of an element is actually in the soil. And we also, which is pretty innovative, I think, we predict how much of an element will be used over time. And so we predict how much, because if the soil is at 50 parts per million potassium right now, it'll be at 49 or 48 or 47 tomorrow because the grass is using some. So the soil testing, the soil test level is not really a static number. It's something that changes over time, and it's going to go down because the turf is going to use some of that element. And so we combine the information that we have from the MLSN guideline, we combine the information that we have from the soil test amount, and we combine the predicted use, and that tells us how much of an element needs to be applied as fertilizer.
Excellent. So before we go to our first commercial break in our conversation, when we come back from the commercial, I want to start the conversation about the Global Soil Survey, but I want you, in maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes, if you had to say what's the largest criticism you hear of the MLSN guidelines, and I really appreciate you clarifying the language that I use, that it's not a target, it's a minimum level, because I know we used to chat about that all the time, that sand simply couldn't reach, and you said it earlier, sand simply couldn't reach the levels that many of the conventional testing numbers were calling for. But if you had to single out a single criticism of the MLSN that you hear most commonly, other than, we don't want to, Micah doesn't want to put fertilizer, or Frank hates fertilizer, people misinterpret certain things we say and do. If you had to focus in on what's the most common criticism, and what's your answer to that criticism, Micah, from the people you heard criticizing this approach to doing it?
I wish I had more criticism, because it would help me to think more clearly and make this even better. But honestly, we don't have a lot of criticism. I would say one of the common criticisms would be basically it would be this Micah, people don't do that. They haven't done that. So how do you, like, you're recommending such a low amount of fertilizer. Nobody does that. So that's crazy. So it's basically people that don't want to try it, because if you actually work this out, it turns out that the nutrient levels that get recommended are considerably lower than conventional guidelines. But I'm saying the conventional guidelines are ridiculous, and there's nobody out there supporting those except people that like to do things the way they've always done it.
Perfect. And so when we come back, I do have another question along these lines with some new research that's come out. Before we get to the Global Soil Survey, we'll be right back with Dr. Micah Woods.
DryJect is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water filtration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zone, all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and playable. Visit DryJect.com to locate your nearest DryJect service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. Speaking with my friend, Dr. Micah Woods, Chief Scientist of the Asian Turfgrass Center, co-author of the Global Soil Survey and Minimum Levels of Sustainable Nutrition. And we are well into this conversation now, Micah, and I'm sort of referring to this golf course management article from January of last year, just about a year ago, where you go through the four advantages of this approach. And one of the things you've already talked about, that they're easily updated. And one of the ways that you're going to continually update them is with this Global Soil Survey. So why don't you take a minute here and tell us about this citizen science project, is what it looks like to me, or I guess in common vernacular, maybe crowdsourcing of information to continue to inform these levels. So tell us a little bit about this Global Soil Survey and what you're hoping to get out of it.
Okay. I will be glad to. That's kind of the impetus of this, because when I was talking with you a couple of weeks ago, I said, Frank, I really like your support on the Global Soil Survey because I think this is a really cool project. And I think you said you thought it was a really cool project. And I said, you'd probably be surprised that we haven't had as many people sign up for this as we would like. And it's still been a broad number of people have participated, but it's an ongoing project, and I hope there'll be a lot more. So this is something where the initial MLSN guidelines came from Pace Turf data. And so Pace Turf data is – Pace Turf is run by Wendy Galernter and Larry Stoll out of San Diego, and their data tends to be – a lot of it's from the southwestern United States. So you'll get samples from farther afield also, but certainly soil test data tends to be regional. So they're going to have higher salt content. It doesn't rain as much. They'll have higher levels of certain nutrients in the soil because they don't leach. Whereas the data that I get a lot in 7 or 8 countries where I collect soil test data in Asia, the nutrient levels will be different. Warm season grasses, a meter and a half of rain a year, it's considerably different. And Florida would be different, and Scotland would be different, and Spain would be different, and so on. And so the initial data for the MLSN guidelines, and at that time we had no idea for the Global Soil Survey, that was based on Pace Turf's data set of thousands of samples. And I'd compared those results to some of my data, but we didn't incorporate them in the guidelines at the time. And then after we did that, we realized, you know, as we'll be continually updating this, we'll update it with Pace Turf data as we get new data from Pace Turf clients. We'll update it with new data from Asian Turfgrass Center data. But we wanted to open this up to the public because we can get a much broader range of soil types and grass types if we made something where people could add their data to our data set. And so we can then look at a broad range of grasses and soil types from around the world from people who've joined the Global Soil Survey, and we can use that to verify that the MLSN guidelines are actually suitable, and we can use that to refine and improve and make them more accurate. So the idea is we'll continuously update these, and the guidelines will get closer and closer to what the real values are. And we can also find errors that way, because if people are sending in samples from the Global Soil Survey and everybody's growing turf in soils that have levels that are way, way higher than the MLSN guidelines, then obviously the guidelines are wrong. We need to update them. And you know the Turfgrass Soil Fertility and Chemical Problems book, which is kind of the standard textbook by Carol Waddington and Ricky on this subject, right?
Yes, I do. Sure, I do.
And yeah, so that's the standard textbook. And if you read the section, the chapter there on assessing the soil nutrient status, so if you read the section on soil testing, they say, in fact, I've got that open in front of me right now. It's on page 164. It says more research is needed on soil test calibration for turf grasses. Such research should include wide ranges of soil types and should be conducted using various turf grass species and cultivars. Now, the ideal way to do this would be to plant, you know, on every turf grass soil, plant every grass, and then vary the soil nutrient levels by applying different rates of fertilizer. But it's just impossible. That research will never get done. So the Global Soil Survey is a way for us to kind of indirectly test the nutrient levels in a wide range of soil types and in pretty much every turf grass species and cultivars under the way it's managed by professional turf grass managers today. So if you go to the Pace Turf website, which is paceturf.org, you can see a sign-up form for the Global Soil Survey. And what you can do there is you purchase a kit, which is 3 soil samples. So you will get the instructions and the sampling bags and a prepaid shipping container to send those to the laboratory. And what you do, it's a $250 purchase. For that, you get three soil samples. We ask you to take those from the best performing turf on your site, from the areas where you think that the soil is really suitable in producing good turf grass conditions. We're not really interested in bad turf. We only want to have the good turf, and we want to know what the nutrient levels are in the soils that are producing good turf. And so you'll get from that, you contribute your data to our data set, and we keep that anonymous. We don't say which soils came from which golf course or lawn or sports turf property or whatever. And then what you get also is you get your soil test data for that, and you get the fun of contributing to this cool project and joining superintendents and turf grass managers from around the world who have done this.
Yeah. So, and you're doing this, of course, in partnership, as you said, with Pace Turf. Brookside is doing the analysis. And here's my next question about this. When you developed the MLSN guidelines, it says you selected 1,500 samples from a database of 16,000. The pH range from 5.5 to 7.5 had total exchange capacity of less than 6 centimoles per kilogram. Sodium less than 110 part per million, electrical conductivity less than 2 decisiemens. Are you looking for that same criteria with the Global Soil Survey, Micah, or you'll take samples from everywhere, even if they're a, you know, maybe a highly weathered or degraded soil, as long as the turf is performing well?
Right. We want samples from any kind of soil, clay, sand, peaty bogs, any perfect silt loams. We don't care. As long as the soil that the turf is growing in is producing good turf. Now, when we're looking at the guidelines, the reason why we cut the data like that, so instead of looking at all 16,000 samples, we cut it down to 1,500 based on those criteria. The idea was to look at the low end, because we're not trying to find a medium range or a high range. We're just trying to find what is the level that we don't want to go below. And so what we wanted to do is look at the soils that were producing good turf grass condition, that were producing good turf grass, and at the same time, those soils had a relatively low nutrient holding capacity. Because we make this assumption, if the soil is having low levels of nutrients and the turf is performing well, we make the assumption that in a soil with a higher level of nutrients, the turf will also perform well. And so that, with that assumption, we drop we cut out the higher nutrient level soils for the purpose of making this analysis, because we're trying to model what's happening at the low end. Now, when we do take the samples into the Global Soil Survey, we've already made the data public. It's anonymized. You know, we've had some pretty famous golf courses and some pretty private clubs, and also public and also low budget. It's a wide range of facilities have joined this survey. And we make that data publicly available. And you can find a link to that in the first year report of the Global Soil Survey, which is also on the Pace Turf website. So people can look at that and see the range of data. They can plot it. I think it would be a fun project for a grad student to analyze these data, see if they can make something of the micronutrients or other data that we share, but we don't really make use of. What can be done with this data? People can analyze it and look only at the high end if they want to, because it's an open science project. It's a citizen science project that we're trying to be very open about and sharing the data. But for the purpose of making the MLSN guidelines, we're looking at the low end.
Right. So one more time, and we'll go to break after we just have this last question from you. It's a $250 fee to get the kit, take your samples from your best turf. You can get information about this at www.paceturf.org. That's paceturf.org. And there should be a link right there for it. And so, Micah, before we go to break, how often do you envision integrating the global soil survey data into the MLSN? Do you see it as a regular update? I mean, I would hope as a result of, you know, the 400 or 500 listeners we have to this program, you're going to get a couple of hundred samples in. Will you, in the next few months, immediately take that data, integrate it into the MLSN, or do you wait for a critical mass before you integrate it all, put it together?
Well, that's something that I would ask Larry and Wendy about also, but based on our previous discussions, my thought is I'm pretty much committed to making a annual global soil survey report. So I'm going to, so in that annual global soil survey report once a year, I'm going to update progress of this project and share that report publicly, but also share a copy with everybody who's joined the survey, because I think people are, a lot of people are quite interested in this, and I think the results are fascinating. Now, so as far as the global soil survey, we'll update it once a year. As far as the MLSN guidelines, when we've talked about this, we don't really see a need to update the guidelines in real time. We could. You can see on my GitHub page, I've shared the code that we use to generate the guidelines. And if we want to, we could just run a script and update the guidelines every day. But we think that would be a little bit confusing, because you'll see, like in the golf course management article from January of 2014, we published the guidelines as of January 2014. The current guidelines are off by, I mean, they're different by 2 parts per million for potassium, by 3 parts per million for phosphorus, by 29 parts per million, I think, for calcium. So the guidelines, if they're constantly updated, the things that we publish start to become very confusing. So we're thinking maybe a 2-year cycle on updating the official guidelines.
Okay, we'll take a break here and we'll come back. I have a couple of more questions about the MLSN, and it looks like already we're going to have Micah back on another show to talk about growth potential. But when we come back, we'll have a little more conversation about some current data being published about minimum levels and potential disease issues. And we'll get into a little conversation about that when we get back.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot and leave services ready for play again in 1 hour. Visit MaximusAeration.com.
Barely able to catch my breath. It's such an exciting conversation about turf grass nutrition with my pal, Dr. Micah Woods, chief scientist at the Asian Turf Grass Center. You're listening to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. And Micah, what I'd like to do now is venture into something that I know you and I have had some experience with. When you were here, we stumbled into the interaction between potassium and cold weather diseases such as pink and gray snow mold. But more recently, the scientists, Chaz Schmidt with Jim Murphy and Bruce Clark at Rutgers University, have been looking at potassium and its influence on anthracnose. Now, I know I was fairly outspoken about the overuse of potassium in particular when I had my hands on your data and we were publishing that work. And I think the backlash was maybe a lot of people stopped applying nutrients at all, and that's why I think it's potassium at all. And maybe this minimum level of sustainable nutrition is a good way to approach it. Don't let your turf get below minimum level. I think our argument at the time was, you know, 150 part per million might just have been too much for a sand-based root zone. But now it seems that Chaz is there at around That work looks like it's around 30 to 50 part per million potassium that you need during the summertime to hold off basal rot anthracnose. I know you've blogged about this on your Asian Turf Grass Center Viridescent blog. I wonder, we have about 9 minutes left. I want to spend about five or six talking about this, and then we'll wrap it up. How would you comment on the relationship between what you've seen, which isn't published yet in the scientific literature, but certainly been spoken about with regard to this potassium and anthracnose interaction and the MLSN?
Yeah, good topic, and I'm glad we get a chance to talk about this. And something doesn't have to be published to be correct or be true. And so I'm sure that they get the I've seen some of their data where we see that when they've applied higher rates of potassium, there was less anthracnose. And I'm really looking forward to when they do publish that so that we can see more of the data. And I think I've seen a number like 43 parts per million potassium. It was like in 1 year they got like 43 parts per million as a minimum. Another year was 48 or 49. And that to me is very, I'm sorry?
I thought it was somewhere between 30 and 50. So in the 40 range, it sounds correct.
And so that just, it doesn't make sense to me as far as exactly what do they mean by that. Because if you have that at the start of the season, then your potassium, and you don't apply any potassium, then the soil is going to drop considerably below that during the season. We would expect the grass to use maybe 60 parts per million of potassium over the season. So I don't like to just look at a single number. So I have a hard time making sense of their experiment because they applied so much potassium. So they were applying on a molar basis, I believe. So if you apply 1 mole of nitrogen, that would be 14 grams. And if you apply 1 mole of potassium, it would be 39 grams. So it's my understanding that in what they had as a 1-to-1 ratio was by weight would be a 14 to 39 ratio, which is more than 1-to-2 on a mass basis. So then you've got the question, what happened to all the extra potassium that they applied? And I know they've got lots of soil test data, also tissue test data. So I'm interested to know what happened to all of that. But the main question that I have is if they're saying a number of 43 parts per million, well, the 37 parts per million guideline is the current guideline for potassium in the MLSN guideline. That's only one number. That doesn't mean that's the number that we want to run the soil at. What it means is that's a number we don't want to drop below. So the way that I figure out a fertilizer application rate, how much of an element we need to apply, is we need to look first at how much we need, and then we look at how much we have. And the difference between the amount that we need and the amount we have is the amount that needs to be applied as fertilizer. So the amount that we need is the amount that we need to have in the soil that we never drop below, which is the MLSN guideline. And we need that much. That's like a reserve amount. And then we also need to account for how much the grass is going to use. So we add together the MLSN guideline to the amount that we predict the grass will use. That's the amount that we need. And then the amount we have is the amount on the soil test. So if we call the MLSN guideline A, and we call the amount that the grass will use B, and we call the amount that is actually present in the soil C, then A plus B is the amount we need, and C is the amount we have. And so we take A plus B minus C, and that tells us the amount that we need minus the amount we have, and that gives us the fertilizer recommendation. And so I don't just have just a single number, so I don't understand really what their conclusions are if we have a number like 43 parts per million. What does that mean? But with the MLSN guidelines, we're very explicit. So if we have if our soil test comes in at 51 parts per million, we're still going to be recommending potassium because A plus B minus C is going to be a positive number.
So we are going to run out of time really quickly here, and I don't think we're going to be able to cover this topic as thoroughly as I'd like, but I want to give you one more minute because I think it ties a lot of questions together that people may have if they're still out there wondering about the Global Soil Survey or the MLSN, and that is, in the case of this Rutgers work, you know, what do you say to the people that, well, it's annual bluegrass, there isn't a lot of research with that particular species, the MLSN is a generalized approach, yeah, it's a minimum level, but, you know, I paid attention in turf school, and my professors told me I can always put more potassium on, it makes the plant healthy. I don't want to go too much with this. I'm only going to give you a minute to answer this question, Michael. What do you say to the people that would criticize it based on species and potassium in the summer and stuff like that?
I would say I find it really hard to justify adding more of an element than either the grass can use or that the soil can hold. When we add fertilizer, we don't change the cation exchange capacity. When we add fertilizer, we're not also increasing CEC. When we add fertilizer, we don't change the nutrient holding capacity of the soil. So when you add fertilizer, unless you've done something simultaneously to change the nutrient holding capacity of the soil, you can expect one of three things to happen. Either the grass is going to use that element can stay in the soil and increase the salt content in the soil, or that nutrient is going to leach. Those are the only three things that can happen. And we can predict pretty closely how much is the maximum amount of an element that the grass can use. And I think we'll talk about that later with growth potential and some other methods we can use. But if we predict the maximum amount that the grass can use, it becomes really easy to figure out how much fertilizer to apply, because just apply enough for the grass to use. If you're applying more than that, you're applying more than the grass can use or more than the soil can hold. And so I would say figure out how to apply the amount that the grass will use. Don't even worry about soil testing if you don't want to trust soil tests.
Okay. Well, that's an excellent note to end on, Micah. Don't apply nutrients that the plant's not going to need. And I think the MLSN is giving us really good information on how to be more precise with those things. And we'll have our final break here, and I'll be back with some final comments.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot and leaves surfaces ready for play again in 1 hour. Visit MaximusAeration.com.
As I anticipated and as expected, Mike and I, our conversations ran a little bit longer. We did not get to all the topics that we expected to get to on this episode, which means there'll be a part two coming up in the next few weeks with Micah, the chief scientist for the Asian Turfgrass Center. And I'll make one for the Global Soil Survey that you can participate in by going to www.paceturf.org. and click on the Global Soil Survey link and become part of this very exciting citizen science project. There's also a Facebook page for those of you that use the Facebook. My name is Frank Rossi. This is TurfNet Radio, and this you've been listening to Frankly Speaking, and we'll see you on the next episode.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.